Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Literacy in history and in contemporary American society, this week on Soundings. My guests are Paul Hunter, a professor of English at the University of Chicago, and David Price, congressman from North Carolina's 4th District. David Price is a member of the Congressional Sunbelt Caucus, which recently sponsored a legislative summit on literacy in the workplace. Paul Hunter's books include New Worlds of Literature, published this year by Norton, and Before Novels, scheduled for publication by Norton in 1990. Paul, let me begin with you. How far back do we go trying to figure out what literacy is?
Well, you, of course, could go back a very long time, Wayne. You could talk about literacy in terms of way back when people, when there was any kind of writing to be read. I think the most meaningful way of talking about literacy, though, is to talk about literacy in times when it became a widespread phenomenon, when we're talking about large numbers of people being able to read. If you go back before, say, the 16th century, you're talking about a relatively small number of people who were educated, who were selected to read, basically by their class and by their by function. There was, of course, a time when there was no literature of any popular sort. There was a time when all writing was really written for a relatively small number of people. When there began to be enough people for a popular audience, when people from wide varieties of social classes were available to read, then there got to be writing that was written specifically for them. And when we say that, we're really talking about novels. My interest is really in what people read in those years immediately before there were novels to be read. And we're talking, in England, we're talking about the middle of the 17th century when large numbers of people suddenly were available to in the reading public when people were able to read.
Congressman Price, does any of this stuff that Paul Hunter is talking about, does that enter into your deliberations as you consider the problem of literacy in our society today?
It very definitely does. One of the things that is most interesting about Paul's work is the way he ties literacy to a context. And that, in a somewhat a different frame of reference, is what we're doing in the Congress, I believe, because we're realizing that that there is no one definition of literacy that applies to all historical periods. And we recognize ourselves to be in a period of transition. What it takes to function in this society in basic ways, what it takes to earn a living, what it takes to claim most jobs that that our economy offers out to people, that does change, and it is changing. In North Carolina, for example, and really across the country, our literacy problem is changing before our eyes. We still, of course, have far too many people who lack the basic ability to read and write. But increasingly, we're realizing that we have a second problem, what we sometimes, in shorthand, call a workplace literacy problem. People who may have some of those basic skills to read and write, but who still now lack the basic skills the workplace requires. And, of course, the workplace itself is changing.
If we talk about the issue historically, by the end of the 17th century, and then we begin to really talk about what's happening in North America as well, over half of the males in England could read. This means that yeomen, a lot of agricultural workers, many servants, particularly in urban areas, literacy had changed substantially. It wasn't perhaps that high. It certainly wasn't exactly that high among women. but perhaps two-thirds as many women as men could read. So we're talking about roughly half the population having learned being able to read by 1700 in England, perhaps a little higher percentage than that in America. America was really the leader.
What do you attribute that change to? Who and how did these people learn to read? What was the context?
Well, I think the biggest force was a religious force. The sense that it was important for people to be able to read for their own salvation. I don't think there's any way of underrating that as a motivating factor. Charity schools sprung up, even in small communities where only a few people could read. Someone was ordinarily designated to teach others. But the reasons, if you want to go beyond that, the reasons really are very often economic, I think, because people increasingly needed to read in order to be able to do the kinds of jobs that would make a living. As trade became more important, I think this is one reason that you find a substantially different in the early years. You find substantially different literacy in the towns and cities than you do in the countryside, particularly in London. By a little after 1700 in London, we're talking perhaps 80 to 90% of males being able to read, not that high in the countryside. And something like that was happening in what were then the colonies as well, because of the need for reading in order to do one's daily work, in order to keep one's records.
Well, that economic motivation, of course, is very, very important today in this country. The figures I've seen, something like not too many years ago, about 40% of the jobs in this country were available to people without a high school diploma. Mm-hmm. And that has changed dramatically in recent mm-hmm. years. That figure now is around 15%. So the jobs that are available out there are just requiring a much higher level of skill. And we have people in our major corporations in this state now telling us that the day isn't far distant when they will have no job whatsoever for anybody without at least 2 years beyond high school.
Isn't it also true, Congressman Price, that business is becoming an education industry by itself after a fashion? Have we come to that when businesses have to redo what American education is supposed to do?
I think we very definitely have come to that, and it's partly a matter of carrying out educational programs themselves. It's also a matter of supporting public education and supporting our community colleges, and businesses have come to an awareness of just how important that is. It's often said now, it's kind of a cliche, but I think it's true, that the number one business issue in this country right now is education.
Does this mean that American education has failed? Do we go that far? How do we qualify that?
No, I don't think it necessarily means that, but I think it means that we confront a very great challenge, and that there's an increasing recognition that it's not a challenge that the public school system can bear alone, that certainly we need a cooperative approach. For example, the new Vocational Education Act, which the Congress just passed this year, has a very innovative so-called tech prep program, which is going to combine the last 2 years of high school with a couple of years in college or community college, experimental program to prepare people for the job market more effectively by assisting that kind of educational effort that involves the public school system, but also other institutions. We have a number of remarkable success stories that we can point to where businesses have, they initially had to be convinced. They initially thought all this was something they didn't want to get into. But finally, they agreed to bring these training programs on site. They brought in the community college people and worked with them in providing training, and they give a very, very encouraging report now, almost invariably. Improved morale, improved retention rates, improved productivity. They've become believers in this kind of educational venture, and so that tells me that there's a lot that can be done. We do need some better funding. We need some new approaches, but part of our job is simply to take advantage of the resources that are already there.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting.
Paul Hunter.
We've come a long way in many ways in changes of attitude. One of the things that's very interesting about the history of literacy is that common sense might sort of say that people just get more and more literate, that you start from illiteracy and you move toward literacy in some quantitative way.
That's not the case?
Well, it's not always been the case. There was the deterioration in literacy in the late 18th century and the early 19th century is one of the is a phenomenon that historians have puzzled over a good deal.
Well, we have a paradox there. We have the rise of publishing and a decline in literacy.
That's absolutely right.
What happened?
Apparently, it has again something to do with job-related skills and with the social context. As people were drawn into a certain kind of work during industrialization, early processes of industrialization, literacy was not a useful skill for certain kinds of jobs, and so the desire, the need for literacy actually deteriorated during those years. In the cities, literacy actually went down. From the leaders in literacy in the 18th century, in the 17th and early 18th century, cities then became trailers in literacy, and the rural areas increased in literacy. So we've come a good way, it seems to me, in terms of differences of attitudes. I mean, obviously, the workplace now needs those literacy skills in a way that was not true when we're talking about the early 19th century.
Congressman Price?
I think that's absolutely right, and we see that transition before our eyes here in North Carolina and I think across the country. It's still a problem in some areas. Kids dropping out of school to take jobs, and they have no sense that their future is being jeopardized by that, because those jobs simply do not require the kind of skills that they're attaining in school. It seems irrelevant to them. But more and more, of course, they're getting a very different kind of message, especially as new kinds of industries come in, that not only do they need to stay in high school and get that diploma, but they probably are going to need considerable training beyond that to really have any realistic prospect for advancement or in some cases for even claiming entry-level jobs.
If we look at literacy as a national problem or challenge, Congressman Price, Paul Hunter, how severe is it? Do we have too bleak a picture being painted? Should we be more optimistic than we are? Help me to understand statistically. And then your sense as you sit on these congressional committees of all of this. David Price?
We have in the state of North Carolina almost 40% of our adult population without a high school diploma. Of those people, we are at most enrolling 5% in any kind of adult education programs, and that would include the very basic literacy, traditional literacy programs, reading and writing, would also include the secondary education programs, the work training programs that are specific to a given workplace. Now, that sounds pretty good, really, to be mm-hmm. training 90,000 people, but it really is a drop in the bucket in terms of the overall needs of our population.
What kinds of consequences do we face unless we improve this situation?
The consequences, I think, are both individual and social. Our first concern ought to be for the quality of life of these millions of individuals who lack the capacity to enjoy some of the basic good things of life and who are shut out from the kinds of jobs and economic opportunities that our economic development is producing. So it's a tragedy for individuals. But beyond that, our economic development, our status as a competitive world power is in jeopardy. And we need to face that fact squarely. Our businesses are increasingly aware of that, are becoming strong advocates for education themselves. But we simply are not going to be able to sustain the kind of economic growth. We're not going to be able to compete internationally unless we have a better qualified workforce. And what that workforce requires increasingly is not just reading, writing, and arithmetic, but the ability to follow complex instructions, the ability to understand manuals, the basic science and math education. Literacy is a moving target, and we really need to think as a society in terms of workplace literacy.
If I read you right here, Congressman Price, you're putting in a plug for the liberal arts, for the humanities, not only reading and writing, but thinking critically, being able to analyze and evaluate. Paul Hunter, what does higher education have to do with all of this? I mean, I could maybe a little impertinent. You're a professor at the University of Chicago. You breathe a pretty rarefied air, do you not?
Well, I'm not sure it's as rarefied as all that, Wayne, but I'd like to pick up the phrase quality of life that Congressman Price mentioned. After all, that's what we're all interested in together, not to take away the emphasis that he's properly placed on the importance of economic growth for the country, but to talk about the individuals involved and to talk about the quality of life that they're capable of. Brings us back to questions not just of ability to read, but of what people read. There's a lot of loose talk about how people don't read the kinds of things that we want them to read. I think English professors always want people to read better and better things, or at least what we think are better and better things, which right. means the things that we like to read. But the questions that Congressman Price has been raising about dropout rates and about the kind of preparation that people have to be able to do what they need to do in order to make a living expand into much larger kinds of issues too. Life, of course, but abundant life. I mean, having the interest, having the range of interest, being able to reach out toward other people, being able to understand what other people are about. This is what reading ultimately comes to, even if it begins and in a much more basic way, even if it begins simply as an ability to understand manuals. We do find, I mean, people found early on in the study of literacy, in the history of literacy, that whatever people learned to read for, they carried on that reading in other kinds of ways. And that's, after all, what ultimately separates people who live their lives more fully, at least in my definition, from people who are able simply to use literacy on a purely practical basis.
Congressman Price?
I think it's important to underscore the role of the liberal arts in all of this. When we talk about the workplace, we naturally think of high-tech workplaces and yeah. laboratories and places where science and math training is critical, but that's by no means the whole picture. I'm alarmed sometimes in my own teaching. I taught before I went to Congress, taught at Duke University, and was alarmed frequently at the lack of basic writing skills.
University?
At Duke University. Kids, the cream of the crop coming from uh-huh. top high schools.
Right.
We did a lot of what amounted to remedial work, just in training kids to write a well-focused and well-reasoned memorandum or mm-hmm. A review of a piece that they had read or whatever. It's not just a technical workplace that we're thinking about or anticipating. Of course, that's a lot of what we've got to deal with. But we also need, I believe, to promote much more effectively those basic skills in reading and understanding and analyzing and being able to express oneself on paper.
Mm-hmm. Let me put it to you this way, Congressman David Price, Paul Hunter. Is literacy, illiteracy, is it an economic problem or is it a moral problem? Do we confuse the issue if we try to separate or blend those approaches to this problem? Paul?
Well, it's a human problem, and human problems tend to transcend categories. Of course, it's an economic problem. I mean, it's people who are cut off from the ability to live life at a certain kind of level don't have the luxury sometimes of being able to consider the kinds of problems that we want to think of as moral or intellectual, or the kinds of problems that academics like to deal with. It's an issue of what's available to people, it seems to me, in order to live the kinds of lives that seem meaningful, that involve what Congressman Price called the quality of life.
Mm-hmm. David?
I think it's first of all an issue of the quality of life and the ability of people to take full advantage of what our society has to offer. It's a policy problem. Let me just add that dimension to it. Mm-hmm. This is a remarkably stubborn and difficult issue to deal with, and I don't begin to think that that the government, or let alone the federal government, is the is going to be the main engine of change. I hope we can play a catalytic role. I hope that we can fund our programs more adequately and target them more effectively. But the answer is not just more money. The answer is going to require a good deal of creative thinking on our part. You know, I'm convinced that there are strong motivations out there to get into this kind of training and to acquire these skills. But there's also a very high discouragement factor. As many as half of the people who get involved in basic education programs for one reason or another drop out. So we've got to do a better job of making these programs flexible, taking them where people live and work, using modern techniques of instruction. There's a lot that we can do, and I hope we can be about that task in the 101st Congress.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our discussion, Congressman Price, Paul Hunter. I'll invite you to step onto some thin ice here. What do we do? Is this a question of action? Is this a question of volunteerism? Lots of alternatives, I suppose. What kinds of direction should we move in? Paul Hunter?
Well, it's not easy to talk about a single direction. So much of it is attitude. So much of it is attitude in the society. I think if I were to say something from the standpoint of higher education, what I would say is that universities, you talk about the rarefied air that we sometimes breathe or want to breathe. One of the things that we can't afford to do is breathe that air. We have to think about, even in private universities, highly selective enrollments, we have to think about the broader problems of society. We have to be concerned. We have to help to set that atmosphere. It's all very well for us to talk primarily about literature and the kind of literature that we want people to read. It's very important that we understand that we're building on something that is far more fundamental to the society, and we have to help to set that tone. We don't always do as good a job of setting that tone as we might.
Mm-hmm. Congressman Price?
We need to be quite clear about the problem that we face here. We're talking about a growing gap between what it takes to function in society, what the workplace requires, and what our young people are bringing to the society and bringing to the workplace. It's a problem that that in many ways is getting worse, not better, and it does have a moral dimension. After all, we're all diminished as long as any substantial segment of our community is left behind and left out. And this is a major way in which people are left out. So it's a problem that we need to confront. I do not have a simple answer. I think part of the answer does lie in volunteer activity. And fortunately, there's a lot of that going on. People in communities across this country getting involved in basic education, literacy training. Our library system is involved in many areas. So there's a good deal that community effort and volunteerism could do. There's a good bit, as we discussed earlier, that the business community mm-hmm. can do in terms of taking more responsibility for the quality of its own workforce and not just delegating this effort to someone else. And then we do have a major job to do, I think, in our school systems, our community colleges, and we in government need to take a good look at that and focus our own efforts more sharply. There are a number of people from all points in the political spectrum involved in this right now. We had a science committee hearing here in the Research Triangle area earlier, which was certainly revealing to me, I think, to a number of people about the workplace literacy problem. The Sunbelt Institute, a consortium of Southern members of Congress, has put forward a very fine study. I'm very proud of that study, which further illuminates the problem. And now it's time to move beyond studying and move beyond just understanding the problem and to really try to make some policy changes. And those changes, I'm happy to report, are underway at this moment.
Let me add a footnote to our conversation, David Price and Paul Hunter. What would you say to somebody who's listening to this discussion? Not somebody necessarily who moves in congressional or university circles, but somebody who is suffering really under the burden of the challenge of illiteracy. I sense some shame, some embarrassment, some reluctance there. What would you say to this individual to, let's get off the dime and do something? Is there a particular way that you would put that, Congressman Price?
Well, you're absolutely right that there are psychological barriers. People do feel ashamed of their condition sometimes, and perhaps don't realize how many people share that condition. It's kind of a hidden problem in some communities. All I would say is that that there are many, many opportunities available, many people who want to help, and there is a good deal that's already available out there. Everything from community programs to workplace programs to local adult education efforts. I think any congressional office in any district would be a ready source of information about what's available in that community. We of course do need to do more, but I would say that there is a great deal available now, and would encourage people who might be hearing this broadcast who have an interest in this to contact their local congressional office, their local literacy council, mm-hmm. if they would like to help or if they would like to take advantage of some of these programs.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about literacy in history and in contemporary American society. My guests were Paul Hunter of the University of Chicago and David Price, congressman from North Carolina's 4th District. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 476. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about ancient language and cuisine. My guests will be William Hallow of Yale University and Torkild Jacobson of Harvard University. Here's news of interest to high school teachers. From mid-June through early July of 1990, the National Humanities Center will sponsor 2 enrichment programs for high school teachers of literature and history. Participants will receive travel, lodging, and a stipend of $750. For an application, write to Summer Institutes, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The Holland Tunnel opened to traffic between New York City and Jersey City during the second week in November, 1927. Samuel Pepys, the London diarist and fellow of the Royal Society, recorded one of the earliest blood transfusions in early November 1666. Happy birthday this week to the Scottish author Robert Louis Stevenson, born in 1850, to Georgia O'Keeffe, the American artist, born in 1887, to the American blues man William Christopher Handy, born in early November 1873, to Cesare Lombroso, the Italian founder of modern criminology, born in 1836, to Elizabeth Cady Stanton, the American suffragist, born in 1815, and to Harry Blackmun, the Supreme Court justice and author of the majority opinion in the case of Roe versus Wade. Justice Blackmun was born in early November 1908. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Literacy in History and in Contemporary American Society. This week on Soundings. Listen for Paul Hunter of the University of Chicago and David Price, Congressman from North Carolina's 4th District. David Price recently sponsored a legislative summit on literacy in the workplace. Paul Hunter is the author of a new book about literature and mass audiences. Literacy Then and Now, this week on Soundings.